Hachmanim speaking.
You are tuned into CITR 101.9 FM in Metro Vancouver. I'm Stefan Christoph in Montreal, and today I'm going to be sharing with you a discussion that took place at a gathering for housing justice, which occurred in Montreal in early March 2025. This space brought together community organizers, activists, and artists from coast to coast to coast to look at the current state of housing justice movements. Information, housingjustice.now. This is one of the panels that took place, and it was called Housing Justice and Anti-Colonial Movements. We heard from Robbie Madsen, who is an Indigenous writer and ethnobotanical healer, Two-Spirit Cree, and has published a book on the effects of residential schools. We also heard from Ahmed Abu Shaban, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Agriculture at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. Ahmed has been in Toronto for about a year now and has been facilitating online university classes with students in Gaza. His work is breathtaking in terms of reaching thousands of displaced university students at this moment. And we heard from Tiro Mathembu, who is a community organizer in Regina and has been leading some city-based efforts there to support frontline communities, Indigenous folks particularly, who are struggling with housing precarity. He is one of the co-founders of the Good Trouble Network in Regina. I had the pleasure of facilitating this conversation. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I'm really happy to share it with you here today on CITR 101.9 FM in Metro Vancouver. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. Morning. Bonjour. I'm Stefan Christoph. I'm one of the coordinators of this gathering. It's cool that you're here at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. Respect to you all. So the conversation today, I think, is a very important one. Obviously, all the intersecting discussions around housing justice are critically important, and I think this panel and the voices that you'll hear this morning are particularly important. Okay, so thank you, Sarah, for doing translation. So we really have, I think, a very important and broad set of voices this morning here on the panel. Robbie, I first met you when we were having a discussion at an art gallery space, Obero, and you had mentioned your work writing about your own experiences and Indigenous cultural history, and I was really excited to learn a little bit about your writing. We encountered each other first in the context of some grassroots organizing that's going on in the Milton Park neighborhood. I think that people will know, and if you don't, that's fine. There's people from out of town. Milton Park is an area that's just right beside McGill University, where you have a very extreme illustration of colonialism today, where you have a lot of people who are struggling with housing precarity on the streets, just a few blocks away with one of the edifices of colonial power in this city, which is McGill University. So I know, Robbie, your work is not just about Milton Park, but we're really lucky that you could be here today, and it will be great to hear about your book, too. Ahmed, you spoke both yesterday and the day before at Concordia University. You have been in Canada for about a year now from Gaza, Palestine, Free Palestine. And Ahmed is a professor, an educator, and gave a beautiful speech just on Thursday where he talked about the universities not being four walls or buildings, but universities being a community. And I should underline that Ahmed has maintained online classes for thousands of students in Gaza over this past year. It's probably hard to imagine what that entails, and you know, we're in the presence of somebody who is just doing incredible work. So it's really an honor that Ahmed could be here today. I think it's so important that we connect and understand that housing justice is inherently connected to land, is inherently connected to, if we want housing justice, to deconstructing the whole colonial edifice that is commodified territories, property, and totally flipped our relationship to earth. Tiro, you came from Regina, and in building up to this conference, I was reaching out to grassroots organizers in different cities to try to get a sense of important voices that we should try to have represented here. And a lot of people in Regina were like, you gotta reach out to Tiro and make sure that he's present. From what I understand, you've been doing frontline support for a lot of communities struggling with housing precarity in Regina, and you have a particular focus on Indigenous support. And of course, people, I'm sure some of you are aware, but just to underline, Saskatchewan is a context where that dynamic of colonialism as manifested in housing and wealth inequality is very extreme. You've also brought a lot of historical legacy around Black Power movements to Regina, which I think is amazing, so respect to that. So we'll just start with the first question. Those were just more just an introduction of context, and I think that I just wanted to make it a little bit more of a community vibe rather than reading an official bio. I think that I'll just ask the first question, and also please to the three of you, add anything you would like to add that you feel is important for people here to know about yourselves. Okay, so the gathering is Housing Justice Convergence, Housing Justice Now. And the panel this morning, I would just underline, it's anti-colonial movements and housing justice. It's not decolonial movements. And that was a very specific decision. We wanted to center the voices of intergenerational anti-colonial struggles and center that rather than centering institutions trying to talk about decolonizing themselves. So we want to sort of bring up that sort of legacy of struggle. So to the three of you, can you talk about how, from your vantage point, from your perspective, and in your work as writers, as community organizers, if you were to sort of share a message with the people that are gathered here today about how anti-colonial struggles must be understood and connected to housing justice movements. Tiro, I'll start with you.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Yeah, so just a little bit of background further on. I'm from Regina, Treaty 4. Son of a Pan-African, South African, from Soweto. Often in Canada, in our reflection on our colonial history, we focus on John A. Macdonald. I know there's movements across the country. Edgar Dewdney was the Indian commissioner based in Regina under John A. Macdonald. There was the Cypress Hills Massacre, which took place in this prime, the grasslands, the prime buffalo territory that settlers wanted to settle there to make AAA grade beef. And what Edgar Dewdney took part in was he created and invented apartheid, in our opinion. And what we watched is from South Africa to Palestine, this be implemented. And so we feel strongly from Treaty 4 that we have a moral obligation and a collective responsibility to fight and advocate from that, to uproot settler colonial capital violence led by the state. RCMP are all trained from Regina. There's been moves to dismantle that, but there's been so much constant push from the state to maintain in Regina. So I think tying in from a colonial perspective, an anti-colonial perspective, is that often when we talk about housing, it's hard for our communities to even fathom some things like a tenant union or rent strikes when we are on the streets day in, day out. It's in the Indigenous community. The Indigenous community in Saskatchewan makes up 90% of the unhoused and 14% of the general population. 80% of the incarcerated rate is Indigenous people. So when we talk about housing or anything, we have to be talking about dismantling the RCMP, dismantling the colonial state pressures, so that we have the opportunity for our communities to heal from the trauma and then grow and create new things.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me for this very important and connecting, actually, event. So, you know, I got the feeling it was really a good idea from the organizer, reflecting even different phases of settler colonialism. So we are just here, like, three people from maybe different backgrounds, maybe indigenous people in Canada, the victims of the settler colonialism project here in Canada, but also you have the South African model with the apartheid. And currently you have a Palestinian, which is, we are living actually a kind of, it's not relatively early stage of the settler colonialism. I mean, usually I got to know here something very interesting when I just came here to Canada. When we are teaching, we are using this land acknowledgement. And this land acknowledgement, besides just really a funny thing, and usually I start with land acknowledgement, telling my students, you know, what is the added value of this one? So the land is taken, the people were massacred, they were killed. But we keep just telling them, you know, we know it's your land. Yeah, we are sorry, we took your land. We will never just give it back to you. But we are sorry, you know. So this is the meaning, yeah. But the issue, I say, okay, despite being, for me, I see it like, you can say it's useless, but at the same time, maybe the only value of this is a lesson learned for the humanity. If we would allow this to happen again, if we allow this at the time when indigenous people were actually massacred, when the genocide happened here, there was no social media. There is nothing of documentation. And therefore, now even like survivors now are trying to dig in the history to get out even everything about what happened, but also about their language, about their history, about their culture, about their life that is lost. It's not, I mean, like settler colonialism and the investment in this land to do this, all what we are seeing here and the resulting housing crisis here is actually on the coast of those people who were living here. But they did not lose only their life. They also lost their identity, their culture. And now, you know, yesterday, Thursday, I was there, and I was very happy when I just saw one of the indigenous people, and she started her presentation talking in her own language.
Ellen Gabriel.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that we are facing right now. You know, one of the things that the Israelis are constantly targeting is the Palestinian archive. So they are targeting the Palestinian archive, and they are attacking our Palestinian archive. Once I was asked, even after just discussing with the students, he told me, one of the students told me, you know, why they are interested actually to just steal your, I mean, traditional dress or book, or a story, or a film. So because this is the native language. Because the land speaks the language of the natives. And this is very important thing. So I believe, we should actually look at settler colonialism as, you know, it is one project divided in different places in the world. Maybe we are living different stages, like indigenous people in their struggle. Still they are living the crisis. And I think, and this is very good lesson for all of us, that we all of us should stand against this wherever, not for the Palestinian, not for the indigenous people, not for the South African, but for the whole humanity. Because it is threatening the whole humanity.
Hi, everyone. My name is Robbie Matson. I am a Two-Spirit Cree, originally from Alberta. I grew up in Ontario, and obviously I now live here. My assigned traditional name in Cree is Ipitak Pisquo Mostus, which in English means they who hear the voice of the buffalo. In French, it's Qui entend la voix du bison, and in Ojibwe, it's Nikwete Wese Mishkori Biziki. And I always acknowledge the Ojibwe version of saying it, because when I went to the traditional ceremony to have my traditional name given to me in 2011, it came out in that language. So they pair you up with a seer who does not know you and who receives the name. It is an interesting fact about, again, they hear the voice of the buffalo. If anyone does their research or knows anything a little bit about our medicine, it is an interesting fact that in at least 150 First Nations in Canada, the buffalo is considered a woman's medicine. My ancestors see what they see. What can I tell you? Okay, I am an author. I'm also a singer. I've received a radio airplay as a singer before. But mainly today, one of my main capacities here is as an author. I'm a survivor of the 60s scoop. So if anyone here isn't familiar with the 60s scoop, in French, it's la rafle des années 60. We are talking about a period of about 50 or 60 years following just when the Indian residential school started closing. They needed a new system to assimilate these children, and so what they do is they started scooping them from their original territories and their families and putting them with white families. Our federal government will admit to having done this to at least 20,000 First Nations children. The number is actually more like 40,000 and probably higher. I'm one of those children. However, I did not find out until I was 45 years old that the truth is I was not born in a hospital in Grand Prairie, but in an Indian residential school in St. Paul, 600 kilometers outside Grand Prairie. My book is called Insanity and Lies, Goodbye 60s Scoop. This is the test copy here. We have the orange color because we're basically talking about the children. And at the back, there's a nice, fairly recent photo of me and a little write-up. There's a lot of ways of preventing someone from reconnecting with their culture or separating them from that culture so that they can never return to it. And in my own personal story, it's because in my adoption record, there are some blatant lies that are written in there. And one of the lies is that both of my birth parents, he and she, were Métis. If anyone here has even a smidgen of knowledge of what Métis means, you should be able to tell by looking at me immediately that that is not possible. Both of my parents had to be full-blooded Cree. So I'm growing up in a system that is not acknowledging what really happened and have no idea what's going on, and I don't know where I was really born, what really happened to me, anything like this. And my parents were on the adoption board committee at the time in the 1970s and had never heard of an Indian residential school in their lives. So I'm giving you guys an idea of just how hidden this was. So here I am, 14 years old, with my mother by adoption, and we're looking through my adoption records, and we see these very odd notes. One of them was that the children in this bloodline have a very long history of A, tuberculosis, and B, broken eardrums, with absolutely no explanation as to where this came from. TB and broken eardrums come out of nowhere, I guess. Well, with history and with knowledge and what we know has happened, we know now about the tuberculosis in the Indian residential schools, and the broken eardrums were from strikes to the head that my family members were getting from the religious clergy running the schools. The story goes back to this. I find out that actually both my parents were actually full-blooded Cree and that I was actually in the Indian residential school when I was born. And this is why that lie is in the document about them being Métis. In Alberta, the Métis children were largely expunged from the schools in 1910 because they did not have status and because the federal government did not give any funding to the schools for them, so they were considered charity cases. So by lying and saying both of my parents were Métis, it made it look impossible that they could have been in that system because they were in the school in the 1970s. We have 200 pages of this system of lies in this book that extends way further than just my story as an individual former foster child. We have a whole system in Canada and in the United States that has been doing this for a very long time. So this is a little bit about me and where I'm, what's going on in my life. Now, I want to talk now, I want to answer your question about colonialism and where it has to do with housing and all of this stuff and where the issues lie with me. So, to put something out onto the floor that I think should have been the most obvious from the beginning, but it's for some reason in our society is not. Why do indigenous people, why could we have problems with housing, even in today's world? While A, I'm not allowed to live in what my normal house would be. Actually, there's a lot of places behind me here that I'm looking at that I should be allowed to go, and I'm not allowed to go there because we have a white colonial system who arrives here and takes over the land and says, you know what? You know the rest of the story. So, okay, you know, there could be how we could be housed in apartments and all of this kind of stuff. In our genes, our genetic memory tells us that we're not, reminds us that we're not in our actual homes, like in our teepees and what we would have normally been used to. And it's something that we're more living with on a daily basis and that I don't think that we're ever going to get fully comfortable with because we're not allowed to express our culture here in this country. So I have to ask if I want to have a powwow. Can I have a powwow in this area? It wasn't like that before. And so they come along with the Indian residential school survivors and the 66 survivors like me, and they say, you know what, we're going to give you $50,000 or maybe even $100,000. Sorry for what we did to you. But you know what, until further notice, you're still going to be stuck under our system and you still have to do things exactly the way that we tell you to. This is bullshit, and it doesn't work.
Thank you. So I'm just maybe going to ask you all a question based on the little bit I'm familiar is the awesome work that you all do. Tiro, when we were talking on the phone building up to this conference, you told me about a few things. You told me about the frontline support work you're doing in the city of Regina, sort of how that plays out with urban indigenous communities, and then also the meal project you're doing in schools. Talk about it and how it's connected to you know, a broader vision of housing justice movements as building from the ground up, from community power, and a community power that is rooted in a struggle, intergenerational struggle against colonization. Thank you.
Yeah, well, in so-called Regina, I help support and direct a grassroots organization called Good Trouble, YQR. It's a black and indigenous-led coalition. We try to, you know, network with other existing groups and just try to get in good trouble. That comes out of John Lewis and the civil rights movement, saying, you know, when we see something wrong, see something unjust, say something, do something, get in trouble, get in good trouble, necessary trouble. So I'm a cook. So we, you know, after a year of we were recognizing that the homeless crisis was not being dealt with, and we had made some asks to the city and they were not answered. So we held a huge meal for community in a park. I actually ended up going home that night, and my younger brother and a few other organizers listening to responding to our unhoused neighbors, they said, we want to take these tents and go to City Hall. So I woke up in the morning and there was 60 tents on City Hall, and we said, okay, well, now we held space there for 49 days doing meal programs. Currently, we're at one of inner city schools, and we do a free breakfast program inspired by the Black Panther Party. We do meal kits for another community that we go to another kitchen and build about 250 to 300 sandwiches or whatever we can get from food rescues or food banks, and then we go to trap houses and go to a, there's an outreach program called the Street Team, and they go into the houses and feed folks there. And then every week we do a big meal, what we call the Sunday Fun Day. We get together with community, make a huge meal. Local labor groups have supported. I was mentioning that the Students for Justice in Palestine had just done the last meal for that. So it's been a really good a way for us to build community through food. Other work that has come out of, like I mentioned with Dudney, he made a starvation tactic and forced indigenous communities to march 500 miles. So we look at food as our weapon. Once we were accused by the city of exploiting the poor by the police deputies and the whole apparatus, so we decided to hand out free donuts to everyone. We made vegan pulled pork sandwiches. So those are kind of like we try to agitate and educate every step of the way for our community and be responsive. When we hear something, we're like, well, how's a way that we can get in good trouble and utilize our platform? With housing, what's really frustrating in so-called Regina is that we have tons of available social housing. 500 vacant units right now are sitting empty. We have tons and tons of open spaces, tons of opportunities. The political will is not there. So we're taking that responsibility to be making our white settlers uncomfortable. We're launching a people over pickleball campaign. So we're going to be heading out to the suburbs, and we know how white folk like pickleball, so get ready to see us at those events. So that's kind of the thing that we try to make them uncomfortable. We tell white folks there's a difference between being scared and uncomfortable. Get used to being uncomfortable, because there's no way that we can have the systemic changes without having being uncomfortable and being vulnerable. We need to empower empathy through storytelling. We're doing an oral history around we invented apartheid. And we need to celebrate vulnerability within ourselves and our communities, admitting to our mistakes, and continue to grow. And so we can fight. Again, in Regina, we have the solutions easy. The housing exists. We just need to be able to mobilize the political will. Being out here, I am amazed at how creative we can be and how brave like tenant unions and things like that are. But, you know, we are not there at that step right now. We just wanted to dismantle the fucking system from and give us what we want, which is these houses. Another project we're working on is seeing an open house and we're just going to take it and then hold it. There's tons of these houses throughout our core. So I think it just comes down to like being brave and being vulnerable, being creative.
A lot to get into there, and thank you so much for a little bit of a picture of Regina. You know, I think one thing that's really important for people, everybody here, is to sort of try to get a picture in our mind of the terrain of struggle in different places. And I think it's cool that, you know, we can hear from people from different communities. Often we hear people from Montreal and Toronto at these sort of spaces, so I'm really happy that you could make the time to be here, and I know you have a family, so much respect. It's always a lot of logistics to get away. Ahmed, when you spoke on Thursday at Concordia, I listened very carefully to what you shared, and many things struck me, and everybody else who had gathered. One of them was the care that you have taken with your students. And, you know, I think everybody here, I would assume, has participated in Palestine solidarity protests over the past, 15, 16 months, but also before that. Of course, the movement for Palestine is across generations. You mentioned on Thursday, Ahmed, to sort of give a sense from the ground of what this genocidal war against the Palestinian people in Gaza has meant for students in the destruction of universities, but also the space that you hold with students now to try to continue classes despite people's homes being destroyed, despite the campuses being destroyed. So this is just space for you to talk about that. I know you're online probably, I don't know how many hours a day, but I'm sure a lot.
Thank you very much. It's really, I mean, maybe I need just to show that map, if possible. Yeah. So this is just to show very important historical context of the story. I mean, this is a map that reflecting demographic change in Palestine over time. One of the propaganda that Israelis are trying to just convinced through the Western media that the story of Palestine started on the 7th of October, 2023. So this is a very old story that actually reflects a long-term settler colonialist project with the main aim to expel people out of their land, utilizing wide range of policies, including even some of them are as ugly as the genocide, but some of them are even, you know, looks good, but they are not good. I mean, like talking about peace process, you know. It is a process, but without results. So we should keep talking about it, but we will never achieve it, yeah? Because it means that we should give even a piece of land for the Palestinians to build their independent state. And therefore, they are targeting all aspects of life for the Palestinian people, all means of life. And it did not, I mean, it was not like by October 27th. I usually use this very, I mean, it's my example, me, myself. I started my journey in higher education in the same faculty which I'm leading right now, the Faculty of Agriculture and Veterinary Medicine at Al-Azhar University, but that was 32 years ago. During those 32 years, the building was destroyed 3 times. The building of my faculty was destroyed 3 times, and they destroyed the 4th time during this war. So targeting and the concept of scholasticide is not a new concept, actually. They were talking about scholasticide in Palestine even more than 10 years ago. It is a systematic targeting of education system. But you will see this everywhere. I mean, like systematic targeting of food systems, systematic targeting of health sector, systematic, because it's mainly the objective of this, to keep all systems fragile, that once they decide to switch it off, they will switch it off. And maybe this is the first even like statement was made by the Israeli politician at the beginning of the war. And even they said this, you know, like on the TV, they said, no water, no food, no electricity, no energy. And they were starting to target the academic institution in a systematic way. As you see here, this is the settler colonialism. This is how ugly it is. And again, I mean, this the white points you see here in this map, this is reflecting the Jewish settlers coming from Europe. At the time, they were actually disadvantaged in Europe, and they had to leave because. And again, this is very important to say. What does it mean to be a Palestinian? What does it mean to be a Palestinian? I mean, is it a religion? No, Palestinian is a nationality. We are the first nation. We are the indigenous people of Palestine. My name is Ahmed. I'm Muslim, but I'm Palestinian. Jesus is a Palestinian. But also we have Jewish Palestinians. They are currently living there. Christian, talking about Jesus. Jesus is a Palestinian. You know, I mean, of course, I mean, Christian, yeah. It's a Christian, I mean, like many of my Christian friends in Gaza were killed during this war. Yeah, the dentist, like my dentist, he's a Christian. He was killed with his wife and the 2 kids. While he was in the church, they attacked the church and they killed him. Yeah? And they destroyed, and this time, you know, the Israelis, they would like to conclude. You know, this is the final stage. So we are going to conduct, to just go for this genocide and expel the people. And Trump, you know, even he generated even how he would like to see Gaza. Yeah? And this is what's going on. I mean, how actually they could reach such situation. What happened afterward, this time, you know, it's something like the Israelis would say, we just keep trying to kill those people, but they never die. This time, they destroyed all 11 universities, killed more than 117 professors. 3 of them are presidents of universities, thousands of students, and this has actually left us without any universities. But then, that was even the aggressive part of the story. The soft part of the story, which is even more dangerous. Now, when we were just talking even to any potential support with donors, partner institutions, any potential institution that can support us, we got a very dangerous message for us. There is no academic institutions anymore in Gaza. The institution is over. We have students, we need to help them. We have professors, we need to help them, but not in institutions. And that was very threatening. It was alarming for us. And then we decided, no, we should start again. The first thing, we announced a statement by academics inside Gaza with a clear message. Yes, they destroyed the building. Yes, they destroyed the infrastructure. Yes, they destroyed the lecture hall, laboratories, research station. Everything is destroyed. But universities is still there, because university is not a building. University is a community. And then we started. We started online teaching. At the time, I remember when we started, I was advocating for this as a board member of one of the main universities in Gaza. We were accused being crazy. Even some of our colleagues, and I understand this, because what you are talking about, professors are just, they live in tents, students are in tents, they have no food, no water, no electricity, no internet. They are under like 24 hours a day bombardment, massive killing. They don't have even capacity to take the dead bodies from the building. You are talking about education and even higher education. Primary education is not working. You are talking about higher education. I said, yes. Even if we get one student out of the 14,000 students to teach him online, we will do it. Because this is the resilience of the Palestinian academic institutions on the ground of Gaza. And this is one of the main guarantees that we will keep the presence of the Palestinian over their land. And I believe this struggle is much more important than any other struggle. And then I had even a dream at that time to get 1,000 students out of the 14,000. This was my dream. And I know that was really ambitious. We got 10,000 students. students were signing up for the courses for a very high commitment. And yesterday, Thursday, I told the story of my student, Salim. I would never, like, you know, forget that. We were doing the midterm exam. He himself was injured. His house is destroyed. His family is displaced with him in the hospital. The Israelis, at the time of the midterm exam, they were inside invading Gaza. The tanks were surrounding the hospital, threatening the people to get out, to leave Gaza to the south. But they decided not to leave because they have injured case and they have no place to go. Salim was texting me from the hospital on WhatsApp. Professor, there is this topic in the second lecture you did not explain. Are you going to bring it in the midterm exam? At that time, I got really a very bad feeling. You know, I didn't know, maybe at the first time you would laugh. But also, you may just cry as well. But the only thing I got from this, I learned from this, is the resilience, is the struggle for hope in future. And this is what we did. I mean, we completed the first semester, the second semester, and now we are doing the third semester with even more and more people. And even we just announced for new students to come, and we got even new students registering. Salim himself, he graduated. He has his bachelor degree, and now he's just joining the graduate program to do his master degree. This type of resilience And this is actually, I mean, I find this is a great opportunity because we are learning from each other. We are telling the stories. And maybe the only thing that maybe Palestine can just give as a very important lesson here is the resilience. The resilience, my research is on food system, the resilience of food system. I just conducted research with women in Gaza. Women in Gaza just like presented a great resilience model how to sustain food production, providing wide range of even traditional recipes, and they call it fake dishes. They just give the name of the dish, but they call it the fake dish because they don't have the material, the raw material to do it. They would use alternative. They create, they are very creative, innovative to produce something to feed not only their families, but also their communities. So this is the thing that we always just need to think about. With you, the communities has their strength actually to resist and to sustain resilience and to support those vulnerable. They need the support to work against any evil project that aim actually to create all these atrocities and vulnerability for the people. Thank you.
So, Ravi, one thing that comes to my mind in knowing a little bit about your work, and there's a lot more that I would like to know about your writing and your journey, is sort of the process of flipping the script. You know, when we're thinking about sort of a lot of discourses or like language that's used around the need for social housing or the need to support people who are precarious, struggling with housing. You know, I'm sure a lot of people here are sort of involved in movements that have flipped the script, but we are in an academic institution that has not, which is, you know, sort of the idea of solidarity versus the idea of charity. And I think that's, you know, pretty basic, but I think it could be worth underlining. You know, I know that you've really made an effort to be at a lot of different events and spaces, both to share your story, but to push forward the strong need to learn these indigenous histories and to center those indigenous histories in the process of struggles for housing justice, in this process of struggles to support people who are in precarious situations. And in Montreal, there are a lot, and there's a growing number. Maybe we could just look at this basic framework and flipping that framework, charity versus solidarity, and you know, and share anything else you'd like to also about your writing and the work that you do. Thank you.
Well, we've been talking about genocide for quite for about 20 minutes or so, and I actually have something I wanted to include on that, because I have quite a good section in my book about genocide, and one of the opening chapters is actually called A Different Spin on the Genocide of First Nations People and How to Interpret It. I decided to write that because it dawned on me that a lot of Canadian adults don't even know that there is a description of what genocide is in our Canadian criminal code. Actually, most Canadian adults don't know that. And I think that if we want to work on this issue of genocide, we have to understand what genocide is and who is a victim of it. So I'm going to read this segment from this chapter in my book. It'll take less than 2 minutes, and it's well referenced as well. So anyway, I think that when people hear the term genocide, a lot of them immediately think of Adolf Hitler and start imagining scenes they've seen on television of the old Nazi Germany and Jewish people, Polish people, black people, and homosexuals being dragged around by their hair, stripped naked, then collectively tossed into gas chambers where they are later put to death by carbon monoxide poisoning. Well, it is true that these genocidal atrocities happened. But dragging people around by their hair, stripping them naked and forcing them into gas chambers all require movement. And so does closing the chamber door, locking it so no one can escape, and flicking the switch to get the gas fumes flowing. So what am I talking about when I say genocide without movement? Well, first we need to come to a clear and concise understanding of what genocide is, and also who is a victim of it, that all readers can grasp. And to do so, why don't we go by what it says about it in our country's criminal code? Since that is the description of it by which all Canadians are legally bound, including those employed within our provincial and federal governments. And at this point, I would bet that most Canadian adults don't even know that there is a description of genocide readily available to them in our code. Because genocide is something foreign that goes on in other countries, right? Wrong. The code says the crime of genocide refers to actions committed with intention to destroy, partly or totally, any identifiable group, and that such actions would include outright killing members of the group. And I think everybody already knew that much. But it goes on to say that acts of genocide would also include deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. Section 318 in parenthesis 2A and B of your criminal code, ladies and gentlemen. And it's on that last point that I will focus to further develop the concept of genocide without movement for readers. And by the way, an identifiable group includes anyone distinguished by color, race, and ethnic origin. Section 318 in parenthesis 4 of your criminal code. There doesn't have to be an actual act of violence or murdering someone outright for it to count as genocide. It says here in the code it can be done without movement. And I'm going to read it again, this segment I'm talking about. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. For example, in my book, I talk about in 1907 that a doctor by the name of Peter Bryce went to the federal government. He'd done a tour of all the Indian residential schools and was very, very adamant, blatant, and very precise with them about the tuberculosis problem in the schools and that it was their fault that those students were dying from it. What did the federal government do? Absolutely nothing. In fact, it didn't implement the measures that Dr. Bryce said they should be implementing to stop the spread of the illness because it would cost too much money. Well, guess what? That was 1907. I went into the federal budget speeches of 1906 and 1907, the year leading into that report from Dr. Bryce and the year of it. And it is a fact that the federal government had $500 million in today's money left over in surplus. And even more at the end of the following fiscal year. But no dollars to put ventilation systems in the Indian residential schools. Then not putting those ventilation systems into the schools made it a virtual certainty that those children would keep dying from tuberculosis infection. What do we have when we measure this with deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction? We have genocide without movement. All they had to do was decide to not act on the disease going around in the schools. So their genocide is actually broader than what a lot of people think. It's currently done to me in all kinds of ways, cultural genocide. Like I said, I'm not allowed to live in my own, what would be my natural home. I'm not allowed to live like that. It doesn't measure up to the knowledge of what the white colonial people think is a home. Therefore, it's not good enough. Where is my culture in there? Genocide without movement, everybody. That's just what I wanted to say about it. That's just an example of something that's in my book. I think it's really important that we understand what genocide really is. It's in our criminal code. Go and look. That's why we have a code. By the way, I'm quoting all kinds of stuff in our criminal code as we go along in this book, for anyone who's interested. So I don't know if that helps, or you know, I think can generate more discussion, but I think I wanted to say that because, it's, like I said, we're talking about genocide. We have to understand what it really is. It's not swords thrashing around and people being dragged around and slaughtered and all that stuff. It is that stuff. But our criminal code says it's also other things that aren't as obvious that also count as genocide. So anyway, thank you.
So thank you so much. I guess I'll just put it out to the three of you about this gathering. We're here because there's a housing crisis, and we thought it was super important to have a discussion to ground us starting the big day of this gathering on Saturday, to ground our sort of understanding of how to address the housing crisis from an anti-colonial perspective, and not to just say that in the paper that everybody gets, but to have an actual conversation with people who embody in their work and, you know, whether it's writing or organizing an academic faculty in Gaza or being on the streets of Regina, embody in their process these anti-colonial lineages, these anti-colonial histories. So to the three of you, and, you know, in any order, in the next day and tomorrow, people are going to be gathering to discuss sort of strategy and movement building and trying to, like, think about what we could do collectively and acting together for housing justice. What do you have to say to people to around, like, why it's important to incorporate an anti-colonial perspective as central to a housing justice movement? I mean, we can gather many points from the answers you've already given, but I just wanted to ask the question directly, maybe to sort of inform people's thinking and process and discussions in the next few days.
Well, I'm going to point to the obvious. The current system doesn't work. It's as simple as that. That's why we're all here. Those people who aren't interested that aren't here, they know that also. So it has to change. We have people here on the street in Montreal, in Toronto, Ottawa, everywhere, all over the country, because the colonial mindset that they brought here doesn't work. That's why these people are unhoused. That should be obvious. I think it should be. I guess to the masses it isn't, but I'm going to say it here. That's, you know, that's just the first basic, most obvious point that I would make. The system clearly doesn't work the way that it is. And, you know, we also have to, like, it's important to, I know that when I spent 15 years on and off the street, by the way, that's a point that wasn't really made. Going back to I was actually 32 years old in my first experience of being quote-unquote homeless, even though I'm in my homeland. I'm not sure how that works, but that's what they call me. That's what they were calling me at the time. So, yeah, we're still not working exactly together. There's still a construct of it's going to be this way, and we're not understanding, you know, what the First Nations people need, or anyone else in, you know, in Montreal or anywhere else that isn't European, like of blood, like not from the settlers. We're still not understanding each other and still not, you know, respecting each other, and that's one big difference. I think it's important for people, especially if you're going to be working in social work, because a lot of saying that because a lot of these events that I go to, a lot of the people in the audience are people that are studying in social work and that will eventually go on to work with First Nations people. It's very important to come to these events like this and listen to the stories of the people who survived this stuff, because in large part, students really don't get the full story from the universities that they're studying in, and I know that for a fact. So if you're going to be involved in these social service organizations, and you're going to be working with people who are unhoused, and in my own case, I'm going to mention First Nations people, it's really important to arrive to work knowing what actually happened. Very important. You would run into a lot of people that are 60 Scoop survivors, or Indian residential school survivors, we're talking about people, like I have a friend in Toronto, his grandmother, this is back in 2008, she's probably passed on now, but at that time was receiving a monthly check from the federal government because when she was in the Indian residential school, they literally cut off her leg for talking her own language. How many people in here have heard of this detail before? Lots of things like this. They don't turn up in the media. So if you're going to be working in the social service fields at all with these kinds of people, people that are unhoused, it is very important to come to these events and listen to the survivors, to what they have to say. Like, if you're going to work in the social service field with us or with home, or with, you know, Indigenous people who are unhoused and stuff, they're going to be coming from these systems. Wouldn't you prefer to know what really happened, you know, before you start working with them so that you're not clueless? Anyone else?
Thank you very much. I think, yeah, I do agree. I mean, like, maybe two things we need to work on. The first thing, that those lies and the hidden facts. And this is what actually the media, all those information that are hidden. I mean, I was discussing about the hostages, I mean, those were released by Hamas in Gaza. For me, I'm not supporting taking civilians as hostages, and I feel of them despite of everything. But the first time when they just got those five hostages out of Gaza, have you noticed what the media here is showing? There is a micro coverage of their stories. Their parents, their families, their children, their community, and, you know, their how they suffered, which is good. At the same day, we have 90 women and children were released from Israeli prisons. What the media here reported, 90 prisoners. I mean, nobody is asking actually why children are in the prison. 10 years old child, why he's in the prison. So what kind of coverage that was done there? Nothing. All the horrible stories that he's telling about, nobody knows about them. And here it's very important to be the voice of those vulnerable, to tell their stories and to spread awareness. These facts are very important to tell about what's going on here for the indigenous people in Palestine, for those who are unhoused, those vulnerable people. Their problem actually is representation, and their voice is not here. So you need to be their voice. And this is the first important, I mean, the most important thing, to reflect the reality. The second thing, which is the community. The strength of the community, what all together we can do. You know, I like the situation here. I mean, like the level of even solidarity by the academics here. I mean, I am academic. Once I was like, I felt really great, you know. The students were having a gathering, demonstration in the university, and they asked me to go and talk there. I was discussing with one of my colleagues, and I told him, you know, I'm going to this event. And he said, no, please don't go alone. We will come with you. And, you know, at the time of the demonstration, I saw like a bunch of my colleagues, the faculty member, they came with me, and they were just joining me into that event. You know, I got the feeling of the community power. And yes, change is possible, but when the community is coming together and push for the change and support those people in need.